Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Do you know that every car comes with a chair of stories? That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date, the luxury package you got after a big promotion, or the mileage you saved by riding your bike all summer. While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with TrueCar, you can at least find out what your car is worth when it's time to sell it or trade it in. Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Then answer a few simple questions. Once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offer not available in all areas. Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
This is Marlon Wayans.
I'm Eli Roth.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Hey everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
The movie business is inherently risky. It has been risky from the beginning. It's hard to make money making movies, especially if you're a distributor and a financier. And that's why most of the people who have been in this business throughout history have been gamblers. The early guys that came and started the business, the Warner Brothers, the Foxes, those guys were gamblers. They came from New York. They wanted to make their way in the West. They were comfortable putting their asses on the line, putting their money where their mouth was, and trying out this new form, which was the movies. They were mavericks, and they knew that the business was risky, and that nothing has changed since the beginning of time that the movie business is risky. To be in this business, you have to be comfortable with risk. Well, not everybody is comfortable with risk. A lot of people have attempted throughout the years to find a way to game the system. How do you figure out how to mitigate the risk of making a movie? So there's been all kinds of ways to try to do that. There are P&L statements, there's comps, there's people that have said that they can create systems to eliminate the risk, to gauge what the audience is going to want. It's all bullshit. And so when I heard about this computer program that could, quote unquote, mitigate the risk, I was completely skeptical. I've heard about these things in my Mike Medavoy interview. He talked about guys back in the day that had a computer that could, quote unquote, anticipate what the audience is going to want. There's been companies that have been founded on algorithms that mitigate the risk. And so when I heard about this new computer program, I was completely skeptical. And I was like, there's no way. And so I sat down and used it. And it was fascinating because it's not a program that mitigates risk. What it does is it gives you a ton more information to be able to figure out the comps, which is better or worse part of our process. When companies decide whether or not to greenlight movies, they use comps and they try to figure out in a range, generally low, medium, and high, how movies historically have done in this genre with this star, with this director, with this kind of movie. And they use that to say, okay, it's basically in this range. I've been on both sides of it, and I've always been curious about the comp process because it's really just, you know, people in a room going, yeah, that's not really a comp. Oh, that's sort of a comp. Oh, that's not a comp. And you can basically manipulate the P&L however you want, up or down. If you really are wanting to make a movie and want to will something into existence, you're going to manipulate the comps. And I don't mean manipulate in a bad way. I mean, you're just going to say, okay, well, no, those comps are better. Or if you really are skeptical of the movie and really want to put a bunch of pressure on it, you'll take comps that are lower. What this computer program does is it gives you a lot more information. And I'm a big fan of that. I would love to have tools of information. I'm a student of history of this business, and I love learning about it. And I love being able to see historically, how does the comedy genre, how has it done? How has the family genre done, et cetera? And so going through it, I was really pleasantly surprised that this thing is really something that might actually be useful going forward. My next guest is Tobias Queisser, and he is the co-founder and CEO CEO of Cinelytic, which is a computer program which takes, I think, 50-something thousand movies and runs it through this algorithm and gives you a really interesting historical comp that is not just 12 movies that, you know, people get off Google and look at the box office off of Box Office Mojo. He really has done an incredible amount of research. And so by the end, I was really, you know, kind of sold on this technology. And anybody out there who is curious should actually take a look at it. So here we go. An hour of talking about numbers and about comps and about the history of the movie business. Enjoy.
AC-911, what is your emergency?
A brutal murder that took place in Washington, D.C.
To do what he did to four people, including a 10-year-old boy, is just beyond words.
A family and their housekeeper held hostage and tortured for 19 hours before their mansion was set on fire. With them inside.
It's just hard to imagine that such a nice family could be the victim of something so depraved.
In WTOP's 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, you'll be shocked by the new details of this heinous crime, and you won't believe how investigators brought the killer to justice.
He did not act alone, mark my words.
Download 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, with new episodes every Monday on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
This is The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
All right, I'm here with Tobias Queisser. Hi, Tobias.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, man. Well, you and I just spent a half hour going through your new project called Cinelytic, which is, I found really, really fascinating. I wanted to have you in here because we talk so much about two things. One is we talk about the green light process at studios. I had John Glickman on and a few other people, and we're always lamenting the green light meetings, the profit and loss statements, the comps, the high, medium, and low. So I want to talk to you about that and how you feel like you can help that with technology. And also I've had Cassie Nelways in here talking about the sales formula, the international sales formula. How are these comps made? How when you go out and you raise money independently, how are these international guys and these sales guys giving you these numbers? What's frustrating to me as a producer, and obviously to you, is you've created this project, and then we'll get into exactly what it is, because I think the technology is really, really interesting. The frustrating thing for me is kind of twofold. One, like any startup, I mean, we are a startup. Every time a movie is made, it's a startup,
exactly.
You know, and sometimes it has an asset that continues on, like any sort of franchise, but mostly it's a one-off startup. And when you're going out and raising money for a startup, what VCs look for is pattern recognition. So even though VCs and Silicon Valley feel like these guys are, you know, they love risk and, you know, these guys all want to put down $200,000 and make $1 billion, they are really risk averse. They're really trying to bake out as much risk as possible. And if you've, you know, since 90% of startups fail up in the Valley, you really only hear the stories about the guys who invested in Uber and Lyft and Facebook and stuff like that. There's hundreds and hundreds of other companies that didn't make it, very similar to the movie business.
Yeah.
In the startup world, when you're looking for pattern recognition, obviously up in the Valley, they're using all the technology at their disposal. They're looking for, is this a new market that's never been done? And if it is, if it's a new market and there's any analytics and there's no data, it's going to be a much harder sell. Like, for instance, when Peloton was out raising money, it took thousands and thousands of pitches for this guy to raise any money because nobody knew what it was. It was a new market. And so there was no analytics to say, especially in the Valley, because all that stuff that was happening in New York, you know, the boutique fitness craze wasn't happening in the Valley. So he had a very tough time raising money, whereas somebody else is coming in and it's Instagram off of Facebook or Snapchat off of Instagram. You can see the patterns, and by having that data is really helpful. And in the movie business, either we don't have the data or whoever has the data isn't sharing it. And what you have done is you have taken all of the data, box office, opening weekend, number of theaters, foreign sales, foreign box office from each territory, home video, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you've put it into one gigantic app, essentially, that you people can use. And by inputting in their talent, the genre, you can make a predictive analysis by percentage in the same way a studio or a foreign salesperson will give us an estimate. Mm-hmm. You have so much data now that you can really break down and kind of manipulate, as a producer, the packaging going in. Not that you're saying like, oh, trust me, this is a new way to greenlight movies. It's just another tool to use that will be quicker because it's AI learning and it's computer-based than just some guy named Gary going, I think it's going to make $40 million, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
And I know that was a very long-winded opening before you said anything. Yeah. So why don't you just talk very briefly on your background, mm-hmm. what you noticed that was missing mm-hmm. technology-wise and data-wise in our business, and kind of how this product aims to kind of help us as a tool to get our movies made.
Yeah, I'll start with my background. So I always was a big film fan. The short film was when I was a kid, and university came up, and then I decided for business studies and ended up in finance for 10 years. And in finance, it was very much about evaluating companies, management teams. Spent a couple of years in merger acquisitions, where it's all about buying other companies, advising companies of how to evaluate each other for acquisitions. And then I spent a couple of years in a hedge fund that I partnered about also buying companies. It was all about evaluating teams and companies. And so then after 10 years, I had enough kind of, I wanted to do something more creative because I always had like sort of a left side, right, left brain, right brain. And my right brain was completely undernurtured, so I always wanted to be in film, and I thought now is a good time. And I came to LA, and I caught up on everything that I missed studying film law and film business and cinematography and script writing. And then I worked with a producer a couple of years that taught me creative producing. I helped him sort of structuring finances for films, and he taught me creative producing. And then I produced my own film. And that whole process, I realized that film is a fantastic product, but it's also a very expensive product, and all the investment has to go up front. And then I realized that compared to other industries, because I had that insight into so many other industries, there is not enough use of data, and also the way it's done, it's pretty archaic that you only do it in Excel, if at all, and then send it around by emails. So we really saw there is a need for a system that systematizes that whole thing and makes it more approachable, that you don't have to be a genius or finance whiz to run some numbers. But also make it available for wider audiences. And in that process, thinking about it, I partnered with my another co-founder that's a rocket scientist who worked for NASA for 20 years, and he built risk assessment systems for launch vehicles. So his experience is very deep in building these kind of risk assessment systems. And he's a big film buff as well. And so a third co-founder was a producer of many years. And so then we got together and we really thought, how do we build this, right? We have nothing. There's a clean slate, and based on all of experiences, film industry and rocket science, tech startup and finance, we really wanted to bring the best practices from all these different industries together and make it right. And so we decided to build a one-stop shop, meaning first, we go out, we get all the data as a base, because we realized, the film industry, there's an inherent, people don't like to share data because the data means power. So if you have some data, you want to keep it and you want to share it. And I think in the current age we live in, that's not a right, but it's also not possible anymore because so many more transactions are now digital and more accessible. And so what we then decided, okay, let's bring all the data that's relevant for making decisions together. So we went out, made license agreements with Nielsen and Graysnode, Variety Insights, all the social media companies. We get these huge data sets in our system daily. And on top of that, we build technology algorithms that are now make sense of the data, because you can have all the data in the world, but it's very... it's not easy to drive right. If you have a lot of data, more data you have, sometimes it's called data paralysis, where you just don't know what to do with the data anymore. And so then we decide, okay, we build analytics around that, and then present the findings in a software platform that's super easy to use. It's, you saw it. It's we kept it simple, and it kind of replicates the way films are analyzed these days or films are made. Just it takes it from an offline to an online.
So let me just pause right there, yeah, for 1 second before we continue on explaining what the product is. So the first knee-jerk reaction I had when you were going to come on here was, this is bullshit. that we're feature people. We know better than you. There's been plenty of people who've come in here from the Valley and other places, New York, other places, that have had these quote-unquote systems. Relativity famously in his court case said he has this algorithm and he can greenlight movies with predictability that is better than just dummies greenlighting movies. And I have said a million times, I don't think movies are more profitable. I mean, obviously, the big Avengers and the big franchises are. But just in the daily picking of movies that aren't those movies, I don't think they're more profitable or better or worse than when it was just one guy going from his gut. So that's the first knee-jerk reaction that I had coming in here. And so when I saw your description and you showed me kind of in more detail, what I realize is you're exactly right. What you're doing is not what Relativity said they were going to do, which is we're going to tell you how to green light your movies and they're going to be more successful. And that's not it at all. What is fascinating about what you showed me is what you've taken is all of the data and have just moved it to an experience where you can actually have the real unbiased data. So for example, when a movie's being greenlit at a studio, I've talked about this a bunch of times. There's a green light committee. Everybody's covering their ass. I don't care. And nobody's going to come in and go, here's exactly the number that all the data says this thing can hit on a high and low and medium. Every single person is like, shit, I better bake in 5 to 10% because I don't want to lose my job. I need to get my bonus. And so those numbers aren't exactly just pure analytic fact, which is fine. And same thing with the sales guys. The sales guys, when you're out as an independent producer and you're giving your movie to sales guys, they're already baking in their percentage because that's how they make their money. And then they're going to each territory. And then the guy from Germany is going, well, I think it's going to do 4. His base was really 5. So he's trying to bake in his own profit. And what you've done is taken all that out. What you've done is just said, here's the raw data. Here's all the input. Put your movie in and your package in, you know, with your genre, your budget, your actors that you want, and your director, and et cetera. And then we're going to give you the, in percentage, from 90% to 10% likelihood of their, instead of high, medium, low, which I didn't even know what the hell that is. I never did. It's worst case scenario. That means there's no chance we can lose money, which you still can, which is right. Or high case scenario, which is like never going to happen. So this medium case scenario is a very wide gray area of which you have a lot of wiggle room not to make a movie. What you've done is taken all of that data, which these people are, you know, just going from history of, and you've said there's a 90% chance that it's going to make this. That's the low case. It's 90% chance it's going to make X. And then it's 80, 70, 60, 50. 50 is where you would consider medium range. And then, you know, all the way down to there's a 10% chance it's going to be the biggest hit ever. And so that's what I loved about it, because it wasn't that you were saying, oh, you know, put this actor in and you're guaranteeing it. What you are doing is saying, okay, let's go through the flow of the movie from packaging to, you know, financing to production to marketing to exhibition. And if you want, you can use these tools to kind of get some sense of people's value, which is what people are doing anyway. And that's the thing that's so interesting is we're already doing it offline, right? So and there's no doubt that you're a producer and you give your movie to a studio. There's a room full of people. And the guy might have started yesterday and he's just going to Google, you know, the box office and come up with his own comps of 8 movies and try to make himself feel comfortable that in this meeting, he's not going to look like an asshole or he's not going to be embarrassed. He's going to have the right data to offer up at this green light meeting. It's all so very archaic. And I love what you've done of just being able to be like, no, put it in. How many? We'll search the whole world for comps. Here's all the comps, and then here's the bell curve of how those comps line up. Make your own decision. I love that about your product. So where are you getting your data to be able to put this all in?
So yeah, our data we get from leading sources. We went out and have license agreements with the companies like Nielsen Gray Snow, variety inside social media companies. And we also get our own proprietary data into the system that we search. And yeah, that point that you made was very important to us. We're not a decision-making platform. We're a decision support platform. Film itself is, you can never, yes, there are statistics, like everything, there are statistics around something that you can say, this is the probable outcome, but it's not, you can never say with 100% accuracy or any accuracy, this particular actor with this package, does exactly this in 3 years when you're in green lighting.
Right.
So what we do is we really want to give better guidance, and we give it as good as possible. And the most important thing, I think, is that with our system, you can now do a green lighting meeting. Let's say you sit around and somebody made a model, and then you say, hey, what happens if you switch that actor out or put somebody else in? What happens if you release this on 2,500 screens instead of 3,000 or 3,500 screens? And instead of going back and remodeling it and waiting for a couple of days, you can now do it in the meeting on the table. You sit there with your laptop and you say, hey, let's do it now.
Mm-hmm.
You change it, recalculate, and then you get a different forecast basically based on that amended package.
Right.
And so it was very important for us to not necessarily be the guys that say, hey, we have a crystal ball and tell what happens, but really just give film executives and professionals a tool that helps them guide them in their decision-making, takes them through a very methodical approach. As you saw, first we do talent analytics, and it gives you makes you think about sort of, yeah, I like that talent creatively, or let's say I can choose between these five directors.
Right.
I love these three guys creatively. They all three would work. And then we can help, obviously, and show sort of how well that director generally did, budget versus box
right.
office, by country, by genre. And then you can get sort of just go a bit deeper
right.
and sort of help yourself get more comfortable with it, and then also help the investors or the studio to invest in film and show a bit more data around why it's your choice.
So before we get to the investing, let's talk about the packaging
yep.
thing, because right now everybody who's listening to this is like their hackles on the back of their neck are up, because there are obviously outliers. You're going to have your Get Outs, and you're going to have your Crazy Rich Asians, you're going to have
which you can never
exactly
predict.
Right, but people need to realize, especially if you're not in this business, people that are in the business know this if they just calm down and think about it for a second. What people know inside the business is that is happening anyway.
Yeah.
In the green light meetings, I've never had anybody come out of a green light meeting and not say, here are the five actors that we would do the movie with. If you can get, and by the way, not just the lead, all the way down, like in Tag, it was all eight actors. Well, now go out and try to get these people. And it's two things. One, it's a gut thing, which obviously you're saying you have to go by anyway. But number two, there's definitely a offline analytics that are happening. If someone likes this actor, they think that person, they've had success with that person, they've seen that person be successful. So this is happening anyway. And the same thing in foreign sales is you always run up against, well, you know, it's a Western, and it's this, that, and the other, and it's a thriller, you know, go get Bruce Willis, like, because he's so big and he's big overseas. Like, but he's a 30-year-old. Well, we could rewrite it from, like, that's happening every single day anyway. So what you're saying in a packaging sense, the first thing you would do as a producer, if you subscribe to this model and just had all the data, is you would look at your package that you thought in your gut was the best package, and then you would look at it and you would run the model saying, look, the pattern for this in all of these 15, which you have, you showed me, which is like budget, talent, genre, franchise, you know, everything all the way down through exhibition, how many screens. The pattern is this is the box office that has historically happened, and we're using 100,000 movies as analytics, as opposed to, you know, Frank and Gary from international and, you know, Gary from marketing going, well, this is what I think. I've seen these movies do this. It's a gut predictive analysis. And what's great about your thing is that's just another tool for people to use, saying, baking out any fear and insecurity you might have about losing your job, here are just the hardcore cold facts of, if you have this package, this is what this movie probably will do. And then what you've allowed people to do is, well, let's try it now. You know, if it's not The Rock, we couldn't get The Rock, maybe it's Jason Statham, or maybe it's John Cena, or maybe it's Vin Diesel.
Yeah.
Let's put those people in, and just not to say that creatively one's better than the other, because those guys seem like they could, you know, be in the same role. But what you're saying is, predicted, and this is hardcore facts of what each of them has done in the past, not necessarily in this movie, but just it's something for you is to use as a tool as you feel your gut out, correct?
Correct. It's exactly supporting or going against your gut sometimes, because as an independent producer, you always have that inherent positive bias, of course.
Well, we all do.
Because it's
we couldn't get up in the morning
exactly.
if we didn't.
It is so tough to make a film, and it's such a long-term process. You have to think the best of that film always. And And sometimes, and the more experience you have, the more, I guess, you're in line yourself with reality. But often, you know, many films are made on wage system assumptions with too big of a budget. And this can help you rein in a little bit. You know, this can help give you more sort of neutral or unbiased view on your film. So there's different ways. But in the end, yeah, all we provide is another opinion that's as objective as possible, and just helps to provide a better level of transparency and as well as a better and deeper understanding of your product early on. Because our system, what we aim to do, it's not like that's a button you press and it gives you a forecast. We aim to build something like an office suite, you know, like really something we can look at. We know that, you know, film depends on so many factors, and some of them are, you know, actors and directors. Some of them are really the chemistry on set. Do these actors create some chemistry that has this magic that we all love films for, that you experience when you watch the film? You know, you cannot predict for that, but we developed a system that kind of can take that into account in your personal way. So when we give these forecasts, for example, that are percentage based, you can say, okay, this is the best case forecast. This is the worst, and it's 10 to 90% probabilities. Let's say the median is sort of what happens if that package performs at potential, like normal. Let's say they all do a good job, and that's what it is. But if you read the script, you think that's the best script I read, hands down, in the last 3 years, and you were lucky enough, you get your favorite director pick and actors, and you think this is really, it feels right, this feels awesome, then you might be willing to take a bit more optimistic forecast, and that could be the 30% probability, the 20%. On the other end, if you want to be on the safe side, you can go back to the 80%. Hey, I want to be safe. I want to try to break that even, the 80% probability. How can I structure this that it makes, that this could happen? And we always overlay that with your creative opinion. So for us, it was always very important. Yes, this is an opinion, but it is still the executive that makes the decision. So it's just, we want to bring the gut feel. So let's say a decision is 100% and you right now base it 95% on gut feel and experience. We want to bring that maybe down to 55%, right? Still overrules, but still take 40, 45% of that decision, take very neutral data into account.
Right.
And I think that's the way to help make better decisions.
And people can make any decision they want off the neutral data. So let's stay in the actor category, because one thing you showed me that was amazing was it's an actor, and then you break out all the different genres they've worked in, what their box office has been in the genres, what their opening weekend was. Then you have their social media marketing reach. So you can really look at each individual actor, and then you also can put in your role if you're looking for, you know, a female in her 40s that works well in drama. You can generate that list, because right now I'm telling you how people are doing it is going, what are the actor? What movies did it? It's not systematized at all. I mean, obviously, it's the casting. If you get to the point where you have a casting person, it is. Mm-hmm. But just as a producer out there trying to package your movies, it's very hard to have, you know, to remember all of this stuff. Obviously I have a long history, and even then it's like, what? Who would be the right actor for that? I know creatively, but you may have forgot somebody that is like hugely successful. Or if you have, you know, somebody in a drama that's a comedian mostly, that you're going to have to scale back how much you're going to pay that person and what your budget is, because the pattern just doesn't line up. And again, every movie can break out of a pattern. As producers, we're always trying to buck the trend. Yeah. But when it comes to people giving you money, they're always looking for pattern recognition.
Yeah, especially in the long term, right? When you want to plan for the long term, you have to sort of find a way how to do things methodically. And I think this is especially in the independent industry, which has a very complicated existence, I would say.
You know? Yeah.
Because you have so many different players, right? When you go from script to screen, in that process of, you know, packaging, financing, producing, selling, releasing, exhibiting that film, you have like six different companies in there, right? With six different incentives, which makes it so difficult. And especially early on, for example, when you want to package or produce, there's hardly any information available if you're an independent, because all the information resides with the distributors. They don't share the data.
Right.
So you have to go to Box Office Mojo and IMDb, and when you go and look at actors, you just go on Excel and go on top of your head. And so we really wanted to help to bring the same level of information to every step of the process. So now you have the same level of information you have at distribution, that you can now have that at green lighting or at packaging because we have all the data. And then with the actors, because actors are, of course, such an important piece of a film.
Yeah.
We really thought about, so how does this work? Because there are obviously like star meters or this and that, and they're based on searches. And we really thought, okay, we don't think this really works. So for us, we decided to go and build different scores. And we started with the economic score of an actor. And so what the system does, basically, we have 530,000 actors, directors, writers, and producers in the system globally. And the system automatically looks at each of these people and looks at each of the films that these guys did. So when you're an actor, looks at your profile, okay, you did these 30 films in the last 20 years, and then the algorithms take into account, and they look at not only the film used domestically, but also internationally, and box office, home video, and TV data that we have. And so now we basically, the system then, or the algorithms then determine the economic value, and we build something that's based on our experience as producers, and we ask people in a studio green lighting, how do they, so we basically just replicate best practice into that score. So, okay, if the film, the longer that actor, so all the older films of actor, there's a time decay curve. So when that film's 20 years ago, there's hardly any value anymore. If it was 1 year ago, there's most value, or 6 months ago. So there's a time decay curve taken into account to get that economic score. Then we looked into, okay, of course, if an actor drives film performance, where or is he supporting a second or supporting actor, and so that's baked into the score. Then was it a live film or was it an animation? If it's just a voiceover, that gets baked into the score. So the nice thing is a lot of things that you normally look into as, you know, as a producer, it's all baked into these algorithms, which then do all these calculations in real time. So basically, you have constant access to the full analysis profile of an actor of 530,000 talent. And that means you can click on an actor and say, what's the territorial value of that actor?
Which is very helpful if you're going to sell something internationally to know. Because, look, I admitted this the other day. I haven't made a movie in independently because I can't figure it out. Because every time it's the same four actors, and it cannot be the same four actors. There's got to be more. Mm-hmm. And so what you've done, and which is interesting, is not only broken them out internationally, but broken them out by territory. Mm-hmm. So if you were really going to try to sell this movie, you could say, well, we definitely want to start with Brazil because mm-hmm. he's huge in Brazil. And then next is Germany. And then you could just sort of pop down these territories and really sort of base, well, I'm getting this much in Brazil, but not in Germany, but he's more, now I know Germany's jerking me around. You can have a little bit of leverage to know in terms of your negotiation
exactly
where it can go, as opposed to just, okay, I guess that's the number you're giving. I mean, I guess that's real. And so just having that information will at least help people make a more informed decision.
Exactly. And I found it very important. I was shocked when I came into the industry, and that's probably not when that how little how is producer often treated like, yeah, you don't know much, right?
Oh,
you're
no.
Like,
not only do we not know much, but we're stupid,
yeah, exactly,
optimistic, and trying to just make our
exactly
movies regardless of who's in them or the story or anything. That, honestly, that's the gate that we have to get through as producers.
And this is kind of where, so this is, how can it be that the producer spends, whatever, three to 8 years with a film, has hardly any access to any information because he doesn't, the producer or she doesn't hardly get any information from anyone besides what's ever in Boxes, Mojo, or IMDb. And then once the film is out, the producer or financier in the independent space at least is one of the last people to recoup.
Yeah.
So there is basically that waterfall is so, there's hardly any chance you ever recoup anything. And then, I mean, we know from the data that in the indie world, 95% of films don't recoup their investment, you know, and that's a crazy, or their budget, and that's a crazy number. And the number is that crazy because and one thing we identified was that decision making, it's important to have more information early on for the producer to make a more informed decision about what is this project. I love this creative script. I love the creative package, but how can I make this into a viable business case?
Right.
Because if you don't have any information, so how do you know what a viable business case is, right? You're just like, oh, I love the script. Let's add this actor in. Let's sell it to someone that tells me they can sell it. And right, they have connections, so they sell this film. And then everybody gets a cut. And in the end, I don't get my money back. I spent 8 years. I'm happy I did a good film. But that's it, right? And it's on to the next one. And so right, we thought, you know, in order, how can it be that that when you want to start a product, let's call film a product for now.
Right, sure.
How you're so far removed from the market, and how can that exist for such a long time? And we said, this is something we wanted to change. We wanted to bring more information to the whole process early on, so you make better informed decisions, make films that work creatively, but as well have, you know, financial or business success,
right,
in a way. And because, yeah, the numbers are hugely skewed against you. If you look at the independent industry, I mean, look at Sundance. Think about Sundance. 14,000 films applied to Sundance last year. If you take a, let's say, a budget of, I don't know, $400,000 per film, that's north of $5 billion, you know,
right,
production value, north of $5 billion production value applying to Sundance. The whole theatrical market for the independent space, non-studio, non-mini-majors, so if you take studios, mini-majors out, was 9%. It was around $1 billion. If you take the 50% out that stays with theaters and P&A and distribution fees, there are maybe $180 million, $200 million left for the independent sector,
right,
in revenues.
Right.
And $5 billion worth of film applies to Sundance. I mean,
right,
there's this huge disconnect, right?
Right.
And this is kind of where I think data can be helpful to really understand sort of what's really going on in this industry.
I agree. And that's the other thing is, I do think that a lot of, and I, by the way, I've been on both sides, and I do think that in the upper echelon, in the green light meetings, and the foreign sales guys, they treat us like children. Like we wouldn't be able to handle the data. And so I feel as a producer, if I really was sat down with all this information, just unbiased, completely neutral, and the studio went through it with us as producers before we started making the movie and said, look, we're just not comfortable with this much risk at this price, and here's why. Here's how the just pure data is. You know, it's 90% that the movie's going to make, let's just make it 50, and it's, you know, 50% that it'll make 75, and 10% that it's going to make 150. We're not comfortable even at 50. We're feeling like the movie's more leaning this way, just in our gut, which bakes in all that 10% of everybody's anxiety anyway, as opposed to coming in with the 10% number. So like, if I give you bad data and it's baked into it, it's already f***ed up because you're already baking in everybody's own personal picadillos and insecurities. And so you're not even really dealing with real data. And then on top of that, then the person who's making the decision has to bake in their own comfort level. So the number's never real. As opposed to, as a producer, we're all adults and we have back ends too, which people forget. So I want the most chance for things to be profitable so that I can make more money down the line. It's, you know, 15 years, I'd love to have my back ends continue to be paying off. If I had that data with them and could analyze it and say, okay, fine, let's figure out how to make the movie for that much money, I'll have that much more of a chance to make my back end. That never happens because I think there's just the assumption that we're just trying to steamroll them and they're the gatekeepers, and it puts us at odds. And that's where it becomes more like banks, like, as opposed to creative partners, you know, when it gets to that level, or you know, the salespeople become more like banks. And if they really want to be partners and producers with us and have us all on the same page, treat us like adults and show us the real data, and let's get in there and roll up our sleeves and figure out how to, because we're all aligned that we all want to make money. Yeah. And that's why Netflix is so powerful right now, because they have all their data and they know exactly what they will get out of their own site from each actor or from each piece of talent, and they have their own data, and that's why they're making so many more movies than anybody else. Is they don't have P&Ls. They just have pure data that they look at, and there's a threshold of you know, feeling like that's, you know, a safe bet, and then they make the bet, and yeah, they make them quickly, and they go off and they leave, you know, yeah, pretty much leave people alone and say, look, we have a comfort level of that this movie's going to be delivered of quality and it's going to be successful on our site. If there was a way to take all that out and just really look at the you know, pattern recognition and the analytics of it, I do think you'd probably make the same amount of movies, but probably more often than not, a little bit more better choices.
Yeah, I think
not in not, I'm sorry, not even in the taking out the gut thing, just including everybody in the process and going, oh, wow, I didn't realize that.
Because you have to have, I'm a strong believer, you need gut in the process still. You need creative, or whatever you want to call it, experience, creative instinct, because of course it's a creative product. But yeah, I totally agree with Netflix. They're able to greenlight 800 TV shows and 80 films a year, right? I mean, no other company no other studio would be able to do that, because the greenlighting process just takes so much time, right? It's like, they have the groups and using a sort of a more modern approach in the greenlighting process frees you up, because you stop spending 80% of your time running models and finding data and discussions, because that's taken care of by a system like ours. All this kind of numbing, repetitive tasks and waiting for stuff, and really focus on that decision making, because it speeds up the process. Suddenly you can run many more projects, because a greenlighting analysis or system takes you an hour versus like 2 days modeling it out by hand. And that's kind of where we are. We think that our system can really help you focus much more on the value adding tasks, like decision making, insights, like which actors and so on, while we'll take over all that kind of repetitive research tasks. And I think this is also what will benefit the industry, also in light of Netflix, because Netflix is doing it already, right? I don't know exactly what they do, but they must use data in order to be greenlighting that many films, because otherwise it would be impossible, right?
Right.
And so,
I think, I don't know, but what I suspect is they have a very similar algorithm that you have for their own site. So they have an actor, they know how many times people have watched that actor's performances in various shows that and movies that they have. They have how many people were attracted to it probably the first day, which indicates some sort of heat factor. Then they have a analytic of how long people watch. So is it just like, oh, that person, it was a flash in the pan but didn't deliver the goods? And then there's repetitive viewing, and I think it goes into that, and you can put all those pieces into their algorithm and go, with this package we feel pretty comfortable. People are going to come see it. People are going to enjoy it. People are going to watch it more.
Exactly.
Than once.
And then you don't have to spend a lot of time on it, right? If you have agreed on a way to do it, a methodical way of looking at value and where, if it's running talent analytics and then running some comms and then running, we offer like different things, because we don't just do predictive analytics. We offer the traditional way of running comms as well, and then you can compare. So what do my comms say? What does predictive forecasting say? What does my sales model say? And I think if you set a clear methodology around technology like ours, or like something that helps you operate much quicker, then it really just helps you to operate much better and more efficiently, right? And I guess you can make more films, you can be more inclusive with people, you can be transparent. And I really believe that, technology created transparency in every other industry. You know, the film industry and maybe the arts, like the whatever paintings. I mean, these are maybe the last industries that are really as intransparent.
Right.
Because most other industries made that leap already. They made that leap into more transparency, into more data-driven decision-making. It doesn't mean, and that's always what I have to say, it does not mean that the data decides which film. It's still the executive, it's still the creative person deciding which film, but it just helps you to come to your decision quicker and more informed, you know?
Right. I'll give you a perfect example of where I saw Netflix. And by the way, this is just my own experience, and I don't know this factually that this happened, but I did a Marlon Wayans movie on Netflix, and I had data that I normally wouldn't have had, because as a studio, released White Chicks and Little Man, and so I knew that those international numbers were big, and I knew the home video numbers were big on those two movies. And so when we took that movie out to traditional studios and financiers, nobody bit, because there was no way they thought this movie was going to play internationally. Home video market is gone, and so it's a purely domestic play, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Netflix came in and scooped it up immediately, gave us a lot more money to make the movie, and the movie was huge for their site in terms of, they didn't give us exact numbers, but it was massive all over the world, because Marlon has an audience all over the world. And if you don't have that data, your instinct is, well, African American movies don't play overseas.
Exactly.
Period. And Marlon, are we going to get him in a talk show in Brazil? First of all, Marlon will go anywhere. And Netflix didn't give a shit. They're like, we know, because White Chicks was on our site Little Man was on our site, you know, whatever other, you know, Scary Movie was on our site, whatever it is, those movies play in our areas. That's going to work for us. We know how to market to that, and it's going to get there. So that's the other good thing about you breaking out talent by international numbers. Those international people have a better set of analytics to be able to be contributive, as that's not a word. They contribute more positively than just saying, "Eh, those movies don't travel." And then the same thing goes with marketing. You have in your thing opening weekend. You also have market reach. You know, you have home video. You have social media, which hopefully will give people a little more confidence in the marketing of these movies.
Exactly. We try to give. Because we know it's not just a crystal ball, we really wanted to give sort of as much of a 360-degree view on different parts of an actor. So we really wanted to come from different angles, so to speak. And that was my experience always when you analyze companies. You know, you have like different analyses, and then you weigh them. What is more important? Is this less more important or this? So is it more important that this guy has a huge social media following that's very interactive? We can also look how interactive they are on certain releases. Or is it more important that he has box office value? And then you can piece it together, kind of, right? And then you can just, in your head, or in every executive set, you can really get a more complete picture of what's really going on, right? And because we're non-discriminative, you know, that's the nice thing about data, you know? Data doesn't discriminate. So it really gives you a very clean picture globally, and not just of the 10 actors you might know, but of, you know, we have 500,000 people in there. And it gives you in a way that, you know, there is no subjectivity baked in. And that kind of can help a lot, especially when it comes to minorities that sometimes don't get reflected in films as much. Right. That's kind of something that helps.
Exactly. And I spoke to Devon Franklin about this, and it just exactly what you just said is data is not doesn't discriminate. And we talk about this all the time, and it's so frustrating that every time a quote unquote African American movie or quote unquote, you know, any sort of other ethnicity opens huge, we act f***ing surprised every time.
Exactly.
And it's like, oh my, wow, how did that happen? And if you go in and you just look at the data, because I've done it, because I've made so many of these movies with actors that just happen to be diverse from a story that was developed, just, you know, has nothing to do with anything specific about that experience necessarily. And they opened, and the people are like, oh my God, wow, where did that come from? Because they never bother to look at the data. It's a gut thing. It's like, well, I don't know, that movie's not going to really play. Or they had one experience 5 years ago where something didn't work.
Yeah.
And it's just infuriating to me, because I do feel like there's so many more movies that can get made than just the superhero movies, especially for those studios or independent studios that don't have that IP. We're just becoming IP chasers, and it's becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if that's all we're making and putting our resources into and putting the best people on and feeling positive about, that's all that's going to continue to get made.
Yeah.
And then we go, well, why is Netflix so big? And how is television so huge now? Why is the movie business dying? Well, it's because the P&Ls have forced us into a certain number of movies that they're willing to make and feel good about to have their Christmas vacations and their bonuses pay off, that they're not. They're ceding everything else to Netflix and streaming and television.
Yeah.
And it's a shame, because you see that, you know, there are room for other kinds of movies when they're done right, and there is an audience for them.
When they're done right, and that's exactly the thing, like when they're done right creatively with the right team, but also the right price, right? And at the right.
Yeah.
And I think this is really where I believe there's a huge opportunity for the industry, because right now, of course, the industry isn't that change where people are unsettled. Like, you know, last year streaming revenues in the US overtook theatrical is kind of flat, even with all these, you know, tentpole hits. It's still flat the last 10 years. There's no growth anymore besides ticket price inflation, very little growth. And streaming that didn't exist 10 years ago is now the number one. It's a bigger revenue source now, and obviously physical is going, it's going down. And I think in this kind of world of change, a lot of people are sort of uncertain, right? Wow, where is it going to head? And especially in sort of the traditional players, I feel there is a little bit of paralysis, you know, paralysis. Yeah. So,
fear.
And I think it is important. I think there's a lot of opportunities. And I think when you really look at the data, that opens your mind up to opportunity and seeing opportunity and this kind of change that we're in anyway, because I don't think this is a wind that will blow over. You know, this is a wind that will change the industry. And in 5 years, when we have that new model that will be the new industry's model, now we're probably in the transition process that started 5 years ago that works, you know, in a certain way. And I mean, then it's too late. I think now is the time to really get ahead of that.
Mm-hmm.
Use data, use all the technology that's out there that it's used in any other industry. And, you know, we are one of these guys that I think build it, or we are the guys that really made it, really brought in insider knowledge from the film industry and combine it with technology, really give tools that should help you see more opportunity and be a bit more, have a wider scope, you know, widen your scope of where can I find opportunity. And
right.
That's kind of, this is, I think, that's something that I think is beneficial, you know.
Right. Let me put, I just want to try to put a positive spin on what you just said, because it's something that's always, something that's always overlooked. Yes, box office has been flat and the growth is not, it's not exploding, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you said, and streaming now has passed in revenue. Streaming didn't exist. So the fact is, that's, it's additive,
exactly.
Right? Obviously, the home video is gone away because the studios made a huge mistake over the last 15 years in giving all the home video to one company, and now they're going to have to claw their way back, and they will. But it's like Steve Wynn was talking about Vegas, and he said it used to be 70% of a casino's revenue was gambling and 30% was house, meaning, you know, everything from restaurants to, you know, hotel rooms to room service, et cetera. And in the last 10 years, it's flipped. 70% now is house because of these giant clubs and bottle service and these DJs and things. But gambling has basically remained flat. So if you just looked at one piece of data and you went, gambling's remained flat. There's no way to make any money in Vegas. But the people who came in and built these giant clubs that are making $1.5 million gross a day, and there's two or three of them in your casino, that's a huge new revenue source. And you can't ignore that. It would literally be like saying, well, clubs are the enemy. We want to protect gambling. We want to protect the whales. We're not going to let these kids in. Screw them. That's what's happening in our business. It's like we are this old guard that's just like, well, this is the way we do it. We invite the whales in. We try to keep them there. We try to keep gambling. I don't know what the f*** is going on over those clubs, those crazy kids. But it's all, you can make it part of your business, as we're seeing with everybody now starting these streaming services. And what I keep hearing now, which is funny to me, but also most people might take it negatively. I take it encouragingly, which is they go, well, we're truly really trying to see if that's a theatrical play. That's the new big quotes that all the execs are saying. So somebody started this rhetoric and now they're saying it all the time. Is it a theatrical play? Well, the fact of the matter is who gives a shit? If you can make money on it in streaming and you have the analytics to prove it, that obviously Netflix is making a lot of money in streaming, then make your best movie, analyze it, you know, neutrally, don't discriminate, and really look and say, okay, if you put it on 1,000 screens, what sort of pattern was that? Put it on 3,000 screens, what sort of pattern was that? And if it doesn't measure up, then go to streaming, because you know that you've already done the research, knowing that you have these click rates and know that people will come and stay on your site if you have this kind of content on there. I think it's great for the business. I just think we're so slow to catch up because, again, we're not looking at the big picture. We're just looking at the gambling line. We're not seeing that, oh my God, that's because every casino figured it out quickly. If it was only the Wynn who had all the clubs like Netflix, yeah, if you were MGM and Bellagio and everywhere else, you'd be panicking and trying to start your clubs and trying to claw back some of that audience. And so I think that's where we're at in the business. And I think once that happens, then you'll have like, yeah, come for the club, stay for the gambling. So again, if you're going to make a piece of content, you shouldn't be so hung up on, we're not going to make that movie because it's not a theatrical play, because you're just going to bleed yourself dry.
Yeah, I think they're exactly, it just gives you more opportunities to distribute your content. And so right now, it's, you know, two new players that dominate 75% of the new and fast growing market. But of course, that's changing now this year and next year. And I think, of course, studios have fantastic libraries. They know how to make films. I'm sure they're going to be, you know, formidable competitors to Netflix. But I think in general, I think it's just, I guess it's sort of playing catch up a little bit on sort of what had been going on and just becoming, going on the offensive, you know, and seeing opportunities out there. And I think this is really what data can help you with, is under helping you. And it's, I don't want to help you evaluate things quicker and, you know, don't waste your time on a project that might not even be at all valuable. Like, this is how much opportunity costs, right? I mean, if you have 40 films and can run and have 40 films and have different creative ideas about and have different creative favorites on these 40 films, and then now you could run an analysis and see what the different risks are, it gives you so much more decision power. Now, hey, where am I going to focus on? Like, I like these films creatively, but, and there might be, there's a good chance they'll also make money. And what we get, let's focus on these films, put the others on the back burner. And this just helps people spend more, you know, their valuable time on the right thing.
It may surprise you. The horror market was dust until Paranormal Activity came out. And then all of a sudden, everybody's like, oh, that was good. And then you start putting really talented people, because they know that those can get made and successful, and really talented people start to head into that market, the horror market suddenly explodes and is now the, you know, the cause celeb right now. And same thing with the superhero market. It used to be, that's where, you know, like, and you know, nobody wants to wear tights. No one's going to do that. It's just a bunch of nerds down in San Diego. And then you put real people like Jon Favreau and Robert Downey Jr. into it, and suddenly like, holy shit, this, you can make them great. And then now it, because it's where you focus.
Yeah.
And if you don't think you can make any money in, you know, in certain type of genres or in certain kind of movies, you're not going to put your focus there, and it's going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the most talented people aren't going to go in, into those markets. So how does someone get your product? Walk me through what you need people to do. By the way, I encourage everybody to check it out and see for themselves. I was blown away. I was coming in here with both guns loaded to blow you away, and like within 10 minutes I'm like, oh, I get it, because it was a little misleading when I first started talking to your people. It's like, oh, we can predict, you know, da 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 da, green lighting, and then I saw a list of actors and I'm like, oh boy, those look like the same actors. And once you explained it to me and you just laid it out that no, it's just data and you have to interpret it, and you'll see the neutral data and interpret it how you will, it's a great thing for people to check out. So how do people get it?
So generally, we have a website, www.synalytic.com, and there it's maybe best to reach out through the website, and then we'll get in touch and we'll have sort of a process we follow through, vetting if this is something that could work for you, and then we take you through sort of a presentation, and then tell you about the pricing, and then we do a live demo, and then we go through like a trial. And so really it's like a classic software, because of what it is, it's SaaS. It is a yearly subscription, and so we build a software services. All you do is you pay us and you use it, and it's multi-user, so our minimum package is like 5 users. The important part is that you can work on the software with a team. So let's say if you have work with someone, a financier or studio, and you want to get these people into your project, you can invite them to the project and they can work on it with you, for example, or your business partners. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of sort of, you follow this classic approach of getting you, showing you what it can do, showing you the pricing, giving you a trial process, like a week of trial or so, and then you can subscribe or not subscribe.
And I would encourage anybody who is a studio executive that's listening to this, especially if you're in a high level, a studio executive, to get it and try it and then put it up against your people's numbers that work for you and see what the disconnect is, because you might be surprised. Because one of the things as a decision maker when I had that job was, if you're making a decision based on flawed data, that's not good for anybody. Certainly not good for your own career. It'd be nice for people to come in and say, look, here's the raw data. Here's our gut on this. Let's go from there, as opposed to here's our estimates based on our own insecurities or our own feelings, our own gut out of the gate, where you don't really even have the right data to start with to even know where the baseline is. It's just coming from an opinion point of view out of the gate.
Yeah, it's mitigating your risk, and it also gives you it gives you more certainty, because you have another tool to inform your decisions. I mean, how can that's you can ignore it. You don't have to do it,
right?
But at least it gives you more information, right? And it's always better to have more information when you make decisions. And this is kind of.
And I would bet 90 95% of the time, the neutral data will be more optimistic than the data you're receiving if you're the decision maker, just because it's just human nature to try to not give the best news. And I'm saying I would even say the 50% line, I'm sure, is going to be 10%, 15% higher than the quote unquote, you know, normal comps you're being given.
Yeah, it always depends, to be honest. Sometimes I saw both. You know, sometimes we did run some analyses for studios, and sometimes it comes in pretty low, and everybody's like surprised, wow. And then actually, it turns out that wow. Sometimes it's higher. I mean, that's a good thing about the system. It's not linear, and that's right. The thing about film, right? We worked very hard for the predictive model, which is just one of our tools. We have a lot of different tools like talent analytics and running comms, predictive modeling, and financial modeling. And the predictive one, we really worked, I think, nearly more over 2 years to build this model, and it was crazy. A rocket scientist and the smartest people, data scientists from MIT, couldn't figure out it. We're like, film is crazy, because they started with linear models, and then we built it around all these very complex models intertwined, and then we figured out, okay, how can we capture that unpredictiveness but still make it predictive and give you, and that's how we came up with that whole scenario that we showed you analysis.
Where I could see that happening on the other side is if you have a piece of IP you're trying to will into a franchise. Sure, I could see that happening. Like if you are praying that Robin Hood is going to be your next universe, or praying that Wolfman is going to be your next universe, that you feel like, I have this piece of IP, I'm going to will this piece of IP into existence. Exactly. So you're finding the comps that'll prove your argument. By the way, great that you do it on that side too, so you can actually go, well, it's actually might be a bigger risk than we think. Are we just trying to will something into an existence that's going to get us in trouble down the line? Which is great to know also.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, man. This was great.
I really
appreciate coming in. I really encourage people to check it out, because I think it's fascinating, and I think that any other tool we can have to get real, you know, pattern recognition, because that's what we're doing anyway as a business, the better, because I'd rather have the real data.
Cool.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you, Talman.
Right on.
Cheers.
All right, I'm here with Megan Cloherty and Jack Moore. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hi.
Megan and Jack have created this incredible podcast called 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, and it is absolutely riveting and at the same time horrifying. It is about a DC power couple and their 10-year-old son who were held hostage for 24 hours and ultimately murdered, and they very, very meticulously go through the entire case, and it is as thrilling as any movie that I've ever been a part of. Congratulations on this, guys.
Thank you. It's kind of surreal. You know, we worked for like years, basically, but in the last 7 months, we've been putting this thing together, all the details of the, you know, it was a family taken hostage with their housekeeper back in May of 2015.
I mean, this is like a movie. I do the same thing, right? So I go off and try to find stories that are compelling to me, and then, you know, take the time to, you know, research them, hire writers, and then eventually get them made. Tell me how you guys came upon this story, and then all the research and all of the production that went into this.
Well, so, I mean, really how the story came about was, you know, covering it when it first happened as a news event. Megan was here at WTOP, all news radio station here in Washington, when, you know, on a beautiful spring day in May 2015, firefighters raced to this upscale neighborhood in Northwest Washington, D.C., not far from the vice president's official residence, for the report of a fire. And, you know, a daytime fire, maybe it's a chimney fire, you know, you don't really think it's going to be such a big deal. And then they discovered it was, you know, a horrible crime scene. So Megan has been on the story from the beginning. And then there was kind of a gap in time where they had arrested a suspect, they had released some information, and then things kind of dried up for 3 years. You know, it was going through all of the legal process, you know, maybe a preliminary hearing here, a status hearing there, but then nothing, you know, no details until the trial last fall. And then that's when I got involved covering the trial with Megan. It was nearly 2 months long. It was full of evidence, full of testimony. It was a very complex trial based upon his defense, which is that the man who was charged with the killings, a man named Darren Wendt, he proclaimed his complete and total innocence, and he blamed his two brothers. So then, you know, covering the trial became it was very complex, because we had to kind of consider two alternative theories of what happened. So we were constantly juggling evidence in a very complicated narrative. So that's really, you know, covering the trial is when we decided, you know, maybe there's just so much here that we're not able to report, you know, day to day. Maybe we should do something more.
What gave you the idea to do it as a podcast?
We came about that organically when I was in DC Superior Court. So this was a 6-week trial, you know, 8 hours a day. And they wouldn't allow any audio or video recording in the court. So on the few, you know, 15-minute breaks that we got, everyone else went to the bathroom or something. I was like running outside with my hair on fire, calling Jack and saying, you know, OK, this person's expected to testify. This is the spelling of their name. Just making sure we were on the same page for the plan for the day. Well, Jack ended up recording those conversations, mostly because I was talking a million miles an hour, I'm sure, but because we wanted to have a record of it. And then we realized we almost had like an audio diary of this thing. And not only, you know, the very, very specific details that maybe you forget or didn't make it into your notes when you look back, you know, 8 months later, but you also have our reactions to things as we find them out. For example, I'm a crime and courts reporter by day. That's my day job. And usually I file, you know, 2 stories a day on different things and go to the next story. But this was really became a part of our lives just because we'd covered it for so long and we had so many questions. And there was the day of the autopsy photos, which, you know, is nobody's favorite day. It was very difficult for everyone in the courtroom. I can't imagine the family, but let alone the jurors, you know, everybody was having a hard time. And so I came out and I just kind of said to Jack, you know, I don't know how to report this. Like, how much do people really want to know? How much, you know, like I was sort of struggling with it as a reporter. And in my normal work, it doesn't matter how I feel about anything. And I never let my feelings get into my reporting. But this was different. And so we have our conversations recorded from all throughout the trial, which really lent itself well to an audio format. And then we got a couple of, you know, exhibits that were entered into evidence in court that were audio and video versions. So we sort of amassed all of this tape and we're like, well, you know, we're radio reporters. We can try and do a podcast.
And the thing lays out so perfectly in a narrative. Have either of you ever written narrative prose before or a screenplay or anything like that? Because the way that you guys tell this story, and I know you're both reporters and I know that there is a difference between the way you report on a story, as you're saying, how much can you really say, and this narrative that you've laid out, which is very much like a thriller. How did you guys come to being able to be so good at narrative writing?
I mean, honestly, it all goes to Jack, because it was one of those things that we are used to writing in short format, right? And like putting a lead at the top, like 4 people died today in a horrible fire that, you know, blah, blah. This was like writing a book. It was a completely different way of writing. And Jack really spearheaded the writing. And then it came to me to make it kind of a little more conversational as I read it. But I'll let him talk about his process.
Well, I mean, Todd, thank you so much. Yeah, because we are complete amateurs. I mean, we really have no experience outside of news writing, which, as Megan mentioned, is that, you know, really formulaic, inverted pyramid style, where the most important information goes right at the top. And then you just kind of slowly filter in all of the other details. And we really kind of had to flip everything on its head, because it's those little details that might, you know, in a normal news story, make it in the last paragraph that, you know, maybe that's how we start the story, you know, so we really had to completely rethink, you know, how we tell a story. And I, you know, there was a period of time where I feel like we both felt like we don't know how to do this. This is so different. But eventually I think we figured it out. I think one of the things that we did is really try to find the people in the story and let their experience drive the storytelling. So if we're talking about firefighters responding to the house, the burning house, we're going to follow those firefighters, you know, from the minute they walk in the door and what their experiences are. And I think, you know, normal everyday news writing, you're kind of more following events instead of people. And I think here we had to learn how to let the people drive the story.
Well, you guys did a fantastic job. And the other thing that's so great about it is as you go along, you think you know what's happening and then it turns on its head. Did it feel like that in the trial as well, as you guys were unfolding the story as reporters? Or were you able to, once you had a clear picture of everything, be able to tell the story in such a way that you could draw the listener in and have those twists and turns?
I think the answer is yes and yes and yes. We had questions throughout the whole thing leading up to the trial. Then we were expecting the trial to answer a lot of them, and it answered some and not others. And because of those audio diaries, if you want to call them that, we're going through it chronologically with the listener. So we're sitting there being like, well, wait, but that doesn't make sense. If she picked up, you know, I mean, little tiny things that we're kind of grappling with as we go. And then there's a lot of breakouts in the podcast where we say, you know, okay, let's go down these two roads. Like if this happened, you know, almost like a choose your own adventure, not right. to make light of it, but like if you went down this road, where would that leave us and how would that not work out or would it work out? And what do you believe? It's sort of a civics lesson too. I mean, not to be too boring about it, but there's a lot of this that people just don't understand the court system and how it works. I mean, the prosecutors didn't have to prove how he did it.
Right.
They had to prove that he did it.
Right.
So there's a lot of, you know, I think it's just human nature to want to fill in that narrative, to fill in like the spaces and the gaps in the timeline that we don't know exactly, you know, what was happening. You want to make it fit. You want to make it work. Like, why would he have done that? And so I think it's just natural to jump to conclusions. So we address that too. You know, we thought maybe this, but it turned out not to be true.
Well, so Jack, since Megan gave you the credit for being the narrative writer in this group, were there movies growing up or recently that you look to that influenced the way you write or specifically the way you wrote this podcast?
I can't point to any specific example, but I will say, you know, in reporting on this case and then working on the podcast, I mean, the idea of a home invasion, the idea of being attacked in your home, I think it's a primal fear. I think that's reflected in a lot of movies and other kind of cultural artifacts. You talk about In Cold Blood is probably one of the most famous examples. And there's another one, a very old movie with Humphrey Bogart in it called The Desperate Hours, which is based on a true story as well. And I think it just, you know, there's no evidence that anything, you know, that any of those movies influence anything in this case. But I think it's a weird situation where art does imitate life or life imitates art in a weird kind of way, because that fear of being taken in your own home is just something that I think resonates with people. And I think that's why people make movies about it, because it is it's probably a family's worst nightmare.
It has to weigh on you as reporters, because as, you know, human beings, we're always trying to wrap everything up in a neat little bow like movies do, right? So it all has to eventually make sense. There has to be logic to it. You know, the CSI gotcha moments, like we were able to take a tiny bit of DNA and get conclusive answers. Do you guys run into that as reporters, especially crime reporters, all the time?
Yeah, I think, I mean, in looking at this case in particular, because we have, it's almost like a matter of like when you start to look at something really closely, then that's when you notice all the things that don't fit, you know, as opposed to if you just like, you know, take a 1,000-foot view, you know, kind of the pieces are generally aligned. I think, you know, that is something that we had kind of struggled with throughout the trial, is that we really were, and maybe it was, you know, in particular my naivete of thinking that this trial is going to really answer all the questions. You know, we should say, you know, in between the time that the suspect was arrested and charged and when he went on trial, there were a lot of kind of conspiracy theories and rumors about the crime, about the motive for the crime, about, you know, did the defendant have help carrying out the crime? And we thought that the trial was really going to answer everything completely, cross all the T's, dot all the I's. And I think we got most of the way there. Mm-hmm. But it's that little bit where you really wonder, is there more to this that we don't know?
And we interviewed people after the fact. And this is sort of interesting, too, just about, you know, our justice system is you can't speculate on the stand. And you're only getting the questions or getting the answers to the questions that the attorneys want. Right. So we talked to a bunch of people afterwards and asked them questions that they weren't asked on the stand and filled in a lot of those holes. For example, another housekeeper, the family had two housekeepers. One of them tragically died in this killing. The other had worked for them for 20 years. So she had already testified in the trial. She's there just to get her questions answered, too, and listening. And she sees something in the crime scene photos that probably only she would see.
Wow.
And it was a picture of the kitchen. And just based on the fact that she knew that house, like inside and out and the routines and all this stuff, she thinks she knows how the killer got in the house. Well, she was never asked that on the stand because nobody cares really what she thinks. Right. We need like solid proof of that his DNA is on this door handle. But it did sort of add to this. Oh, well, that makes sense. You know, and we go into that whole theory. So we tried to do extra reporting to, you know, fill in those gaps for the listener as well.
Well, I will say that it plays out as good as any movie that is out there right now. So if anybody is interested in true crime and great storytelling, they should definitely listen to this. Where can they find 22 Hours in American Nightmare? Where's the best place to find it?
We are on Podcast One and we are on Apple iTunes or Apple Podcasts, as it's called now. But really anywhere you get your podcasts, we're really, you know, really happy to share it. And thank you for the compliment. That means a lot.
Well, Megan and Jack, great job, guys. I'm a huge fan of your writing and the way that you guys have presented this case, and I'm just thrilled to be able to have you guys on today.
Thank you, Todd.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.